If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I hope that for all those people for whom Wolf Hall remains on their bedside table, this might offer an incentive to pick the books up and read them in earnest.
That was Peter Kosminski discussing the new BBC adaptation of Wolf Hall and Bring Up the Bodies.
The nation took a long time to stagger into rebellion, but eventually it did. And when it did, it became seriously territorial.
And that was David Crouch on England's bloody 12th century civil war. You're listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available from all good newsagents or via subscription. Check out our latest subscription deals at historyextra.com/subscribe. The magazine is also now available on many digital devices, including the iPad, iPhone, Kindle, Kindle Fire, Google Play, Kobo and Zinio. Look out for us in your App Store or newsstand, or find out more at historyextra.com/digital. Welcome to our second podcast of January 2015. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History magazine. Tudor history lovers will no doubt be glued to their television screens this month as the eagerly awaited adaptation of Hilary Mantel's Booker Prize-winning novels Wolf Hall and Bring Up the Bodies is due to begin on BBC Two. Our features editor, Charlotte Hodgman, was lucky enough to interview the series director, Peter Kosminski, to find out what viewers can expect from the show and what he really thinks about its lead character, Thomas Cromwell.
So, Peter, what I'd like to know first is what actually drew you to the project? Are you a history buff yourself?
Well, I was a science student originally at university, so I haven't really got any history credentials in the academic sense, although I've always been interested in history. I suppose taken a fairly cautious view about historical novels, wondering occasionally whether the people who've written them have been a bit cavalier with the historical research, because I tend to work on factual programs in the main, or dramas based on factual events, and we put a great deal of emphasis on our research process. I have been cautious, just as a reader myself, about historical novels, but of course Hilary Mantel spent 5 years researching Wolf Hall and Bring Up the Bodies, and when I read them, you know, it was the strength and the depth of her research was immediately apparent. So I was already a fan of the books. And, you know, it's not often in one's professional life that you get offered an opportunity to make a television program based on two Booker Prize winning novels. So it's not something one would turn down, really.
No, I mean, the series sort of distills sort of 1,000 pages, doesn't it, into only 6 hours of film. I mean, that must have been a huge challenge.
Well, I think if Wolf Hall is successful, and of course that's very much in the lap of the gods at the moment, it will be because of the extraordinary achievement of Peter Strawn, the screenwriter, who, as you rightly say, has taken just about 1,000 pages of pretty dense prose and turned it in an extraordinarily compelling and coherent way into 6 hours, six episodes of television script. You know, obviously, when one hears of a process of abridgment that is that dramatic, you assume that huge chunks of material are going to have to be discarded. And knowing the books pretty well, what was astonishing to me was that when I got to the end of the first drafts of the six scripts, which I have to say, just as pieces of writing, were the best scripts I'd ever read, I was astonished that I didn't really feel as if a great deal had been left out. Now, of course, when you lift the hood and start to look at the mechanics of what Peter's done, and I do a bit of writing myself, so I was curious, it's incredibly clever the way he's managed to keep the coherence of the story, keep that sense of being inside Cromwell's interior world with such a restricted time canvas.
Mm. And of course, so much of the books happen inside the characters' own heads, is their thoughts. I mean, how do you translate that onto the screen?
Well, of course, historically, that's been done with voiceover. But we've sort of, as a medium, we've rather turned our faces against voiceover these days. If you think of the job that John Mortimer did on the Evelyn Waugh novel *Brideshead Revisited*, which, you know, in my memory was one of the high points of television drama, there was a great deal of voiceover from the Charles Ryder character, but we do a lot less of that now. And Peter Strawn made a decision, I think rightly, not to use voiceover in *Wolf Hall*. So, as you imply, we were faced with an interesting challenge. You know, a good deal of Wolf Hall, although written in the third person, is very much within the mind of the central character, Thomas Cromwell. We've tried to address that in two ways, really. First of all, in the shooting style, by which I mean that the camera follows Cromwell around. It virtually sits on his shoulder. It tends to be shot in a point of view and a reaction style. So we see what Cromwell sees, and then we come back onto his face to see his reaction to what he's seeing. So in that sense of film grammar, we try to help the audience to feel that they are viewing events through Cromwell's eyes. And the other way is to punctuate the various episodes with scenes of memory, in some cases, scenes of fantasy, all events that are there in the books, but which help us to identify Cromwell not just as the main character, but our point of view character.
And what is actually your impression of Thomas Cromwell? I mean, how do you think he'll come across to your audience?
Well, when I first started on this project, I was lucky enough to be able to spend quite a bit of time with Hilary Mantel, and she's been really generous in sharing her research and her conclusions and her opinions, in particular about character, right from the start, which helped me a great deal, incidentally, in the casting of the programs. And one of the things that Hilary said to me early on was, with Cromwell, what you see is absolutely not what you get. Now, I think I know what she meant by that, which is that the interior and the exterior are very different. Here is a man who has an almost chameleon-like ability to present different exterior personas depending upon the situation. He changes his colors in that sense to suit the surroundings. But inside is a darker, a very complex human being, and thinking about what his driving motivation is through this span of story is one of the subjects that Mark Rylance, who plays the character, and I spent a good deal of time in rehearsal and before and afterwards discussing. The other thing to say about Cromwell, and this is another central aspect of Wolf Hall, is that he's a pragmatist. He learns this from his surrogate father, Cardinal Wolsey, who was also a great pragmatist. And Wolf Hall sees Cromwell, the arch pragmatist, faced against Sir Thomas More, who is presented in Hilary Mantel's interpretation as a man driven entirely by principle, who is unbending in his adherence to his own principles, to the point where he will willingly walk to his death and leave his family bereft rather than bend on principle. Now that is a very interesting way of dramatizing it, the religious debate that was taking place in England at this point. And Hilary has chosen to dramatize it in the debates that come to their climax in episode 4 of our serial between More and Cromwell.
And the relationship between Anne Boleyn and Cromwell is actually really as important as that of Henry VIII and Anne. Will your audience get that impression, do you think, from the series?
Very much so. In fact, I would say that if you think that our story, which, as I say, encompasses Wolf Hall and Bring Up the Bodies, begins fairly adjacent to the first time Cromwell meets Anne Boleyn and ends with Anne Boleyn's death, you can see that the arc of the relationship, the ebb and flow of the relationship between Cromwell and Anne Boleyn is really the central spine of our story.
Mm. And of course, Henry himself is quite a complex character in history. That must have also been quite hard to get that across, because I suppose people had this view of Henry as his sort of in his later years, perhaps. But this is Henry at a younger age. How has that come across?
Well, I should say that the interpretation of character that we employ is absolutely Hilary Mantel's interpretation. It won't surprise anyone who knows the books to hear me say that Wolf Hall is revisionist history. Hilary has chosen to take somebody who's generally been regarded in history as a villain, Thomas Cromwell, and pit him against somebody who has generally in history been regarded as a saint, Sir Thomas More, and appear to put right on Cromwell's side. And in the same way, her interpretation of Henry is, at least in my contention, revisionist, in the sense that she reminds us that Henry, in his younger years, before his jousting accident and his huge swelling in size, was an extraordinary figure, the archetypal Renaissance man, really. He was... as well as being a hugely accomplished sportsman and athlete, he was a musician, he was an architect, he designed clothes. You know, he was a highly intelligent and, above all, an extremely charismatic figure. And the challenge we faced was to try to bring that character to life as conceived by Hilary and not get bogged down in the previous interpretations, which has sometimes veered a little bit more towards caricature.
Mm. When you first read the script, did you have people in mind for the cast? Did people sort of jump out at you and you think, oh, that person, you know, Mark, for example, for Cromwell?
Well, Mark Rylance and I have worked together previously on a Channel 4 drama called The Government Inspector, where Mark played the weapons inspector, Dr. David Kelly, who committed suicide at around the time of the Iraq War. And so we had been eager to work together again. And Mark was attached to Wolf Hall when I became involved. So from my point of view, it was something I'd been looking to do for years, to find another really meaty project for Mark But in this, on this occasion, he got there before me. He was approached by the producers, agreed to play the role, and I would imagine, you know, he had some involvement in the choice of me as director. And I did, in fact, because this was such an ambitious piece and the characters were so well drawn and I knew I needed really accomplished actors, I turned to two other actors that I have worked with previously, Damien Lewis, who I worked with on the BBC drama Warriors about the Cheshires and their peacekeeping role in Bosnia. I asked Damien Lewis if he would like to play Henry VIII, and Claire Foy, with whom I've more recently worked on the Channel 4 drama The Promise, to play Anne Boleyn. And for Claire, it was a particular challenge because Anne is depicted in Peter Strawn's scripts as quite an unlikable character for much of the drama. And yet by the end, by episode 6, she has to absolutely break your heart. And Cromwell's heart. And so to find an actor who could not pull the punches of the earlier, more difficult sections and yet still deliver that emotional climax for us at the end of the serial was always going to be a challenge. And I knew that Claire, because she played a lead for me before, I knew that she'd be able to accomplish that.
Mm. I mean, and also the number of characters you've had to cast is quite large as well, isn't it? Something like 100. I mean, where do you start with that sort of number of people?
Well, you start with a really good casting director, and I was lucky enough to work with, I suppose, arguably the leading casting directing team in the country, Nina Gold and Robert Stern. And they went about it very systematically. We had many months spent in casting because I tend to be quite exhaustive about the process. And for most of the parts, we saw a large number of candidates, put them on tape, had them auditioning various scenes from Peter's scripts, and just worked our way towards the process over many months in a small and rather airless room.
The play of Wolf Hall, which is currently sort of taking place in London, has that influenced you at all?
Well, as a matter of fact, I made a point of not going to see it until we'd finished shooting, primarily because I didn't want to risk being influenced by it. Now, I knew that Hilary Mantel had been very involved in the stage version, and it was very, very close to her heart. So, you know, I had to explain to her why I didn't go to see it. I didn't want to offend her. Also, Ben Miles, who's playing Cromwell on stage, is an actor I've worked with 3 times previously on film, and I think of him as a friend. So I also had to make my excuses to him. But I was concerned that if I went to see the play, something subconsciously might lodge. I have been to see the stage version of Wolf Hall since shooting, and I did enjoy it, but it takes a completely different approach to the material from Peter Strawn's screen adaptation. So I think for lovers of the book who've seen the stage version, they'll find this a very different and I hope, obviously, an illuminating experience.
Mm. I mean, that brings me on to my next question, actually. Mantel's books have been read by millions of people. What do you think you can bring extra to the story that they won't maybe have got from the books?
Let there not be any doubt that watching the television serial is no substitute for reading the books. You know, these are some of the finest books written recently, and to read them is an absolute joy and a pleasure. So I hope that nobody would come to the television program as an excuse for not reading the books. But having said that, it became almost a joke the number of times in preparing Wolf Hall that people said to me and others, "Oh yeah, no, that book's it's been on my bedside table, but I don't know, it's in the pile." Or occasionally people say, "Oh well, you know, I did try, but I didn't really get far past the first 100 pages." And, you know, the books are challenging. There's no question. They are ambitious pieces of writing which come off magnificently, but they're not exactly a sort of easy read, at least until you get well into them. So I hope that for all those people for whom Wolf Hall remains on their bedside table, this might offer an incentive to pick the books up and read them in earnest.
It must have felt quite special filming at sites that had a direct link with some of the characters that you're bringing to life.
Yes, absolutely. And I think for the actors as well, you know, for example, for Damian Lewis and Claire Foy playing Henry and Anne Boleyn, to stand in the gallery at Penshurst Place, knowing that 500 years previously, their prototype characters had stood in that very room, you know, must have been an extraordinary experience. I mean, there were sacrifices we had to make to allow us to do that. I mean, I have been making television programs for 35 years. I've never, ever known a situation where you're shooting rather an important drama scene in a room and you have to stop every half an hour for 10 minutes to allow a tour party to walk through your set. From our point of view, you know, that it added to the atmosphere hugely that we were in some of the real spaces. But to counter that, there were certain, shall we say, politely, compromises we had to make to allow us to shoot in those spaces.
That was Peter Kosminski. The 6-part dramatisation of Wolf Hall is due to begin on Wednesday, the 21st of January at 9 p.m. on BBC Two. And if you'd like to read more about Wolf Hall, then why not check out our January issue, where you'll find a double interview with Wolf Hall author Hilary Mantel and Thomas Cromwell biographer Dermot McCulloch. They're talking about the books, the series, and the Tudor court that inspired them. Also in this month's issue, we explore the closing months of the Second World War from a military and domestic perspective. We find out about Charles II's sex obsession. And we meet a medieval king and knight who mirror the legend of King Arthur and Lancelot. You can get hold of our January issue in all good newsagents and digitally. And if you'd like to take out a print subscription and you're in the UK, you can currently take advantage of a special offer whereby you'll get your first 5 issues for just £1 each. Visit historyextra.com/subscribe to find out more about this deal, which ends on the 28th of January. And if Wolf Hall whets your appetite for all things Tudor, then you might be interested on our new digital mini-guide, which tells the story of this fascinating dynasty through 50 moments that mattered most. It's available now from the BBC History Magazine app on both the iPad and iPhone.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
Now it's time for the latest history news with our website editor, Emma McFarnan.
History textbooks are designed for the, quote, supposedly minimal attention spans of today's pupils, a prominent history teacher has said. Writing in the latest issue of TES, Robert Peel, a history teacher at the West London Free School, said today's textbooks rely too heavily on magazine-style bite-sized chunks of text and deprive students of serious historical storytelling that was prevalent from the 1950s through to the 1970s. Peel wrote, "An ongoing issue I have with the key Stage 3 history books is their lack of extended narrative. You would be hard-pushed to find a stretch of more than 200 words that is not broken by a cartoon, a snippet of so-called source material, or a funny fact. What do you think about Peel's statements? Share your views by tweeting us at History Extra, or by posting on our Facebook page." In other news, genealogists from the University of Leicester claim actor Benedict Cumberbatch and Richard III are cousins. According to Professor Kevin Shurer, the Sherlock star, who is set to play the Plantagenet King on screen later this year, is Richard's third cousin 16 times removed. It is estimated that between 1 million and 17 million people in the UK are connected in some way to Richard, the Telegraph reports. But Professor Shurer said, "Cumberbatch is more direct because he is a third cousin. Most other relatives would be much lower order cousins. I think the Queen would be a third cousin several times removed as well." Cumberbatch will play Richard in the upcoming BBC Two drama series The Hollow Crown, King Richard III. Meanwhile, a Second World War veteran who last year absconded from his nursing home to attend the 70th anniversary D-Day commemorations in France has died. Bernard Jordan, a 90-year-old former Navy officer, died peacefully in hospital, according to a statement by the company that runs the Pines Care Home in Hove, East Sussex, where Mr. Jordan, known as Bernie, lived. Mr. Jordan sparked a police search and made global headlines in June last year when he crossed the Channel wearing his war medals under a grey mac. Asked at the time why he travelled to Normandy, Mr. Jordan said, "My thoughts were with my mates who had been killed. I was going across to pay my respects. I was a bit off course, but I got there." Amanda Scott, the managing director of Gracewell Healthcare, said, "Bernie caught the world's imagination last year when he made his surprise trip to France and brought a huge amount of joy to a lot of people. He will be much missed by everyone here, and our thoughts and prayers go out to his wife."
Thank you, Emma. Before our next interview, here's a reminder that we have two upcoming reader events taking place this March. On the 21st and 22nd of the month, we're holding two-day events themed around Magna Carta and Waterloo. At each event, you'll get the chance to hear from a selection of expert speakers and enjoy a buffet lunch. For more details and tickets, please visit historyextra.com/events. And as always, magazine subscribers will get discounted entry. In 1135, the death of King Henry I triggered a vicious civil war in England, as his daughter Matilda and his nephew Stephen fought to secure the crown. To find out more about this bloody conflict, we sent Charlotte Hodgman to visit Wallingford Castle in Oxfordshire, in the company of Professor David Crouch from the University of Hull.
Right, so David, we've come to Wallingford. We're standing in the castle meadows. And we were going to have a chat about the period of Stephen and Matilda, the sort of power struggles for the throne. When did this all sort of start?
Well, succession was always a flashpoint in any medieval nation's history. And in England particularly, in fact, England was notorious for the fact that it actually had no succession customs. You know, the person who got the throne was generally the person who made the most of the opportunity that he had. England had never had an undisputed father-to-son succession since the 10th century. So everybody knew that when the old king died, what would follow would be, well, a gap until the political community or military force sorted out who would be the next one. Mm. I mean, Henry I, the immediate predecessor of Stephen, he opportunistically took the throne when his brother died in a hunting accident in 1100. Even though, in fact, he had an elder brother, Robert, who had a claim. Henry grabbed the throne because he was with his brother's hunting party, and he just rode for London and lassoed a bishop and managed to get himself crowned within about 4 days of his brother's death. But that, of course, did not stop his elder brother, Robert Curto's Duke of Normandy, disputing it and indeed leading an army to England to a face-off in Alton in Hampshire when they eventually sorted things out amicably. But it didn't always work out amicably. Of course, the Norman Conquest was yet another succession debate. And really, anybody, if they're in a position, could claim the throne. Okay. Henry I, when he died, before he died, actually attempted, as some kings did, to nominate his successor. That gave you a claim. In his case, he only had one legitimate child left to him, which was his daughter, Matilda, who was the previous Empress of Germany, but had returned home after her husband's death in 1125. And by 1127, it was quite clear that Henry I was going to have no more children, at least by his lawfully wedded wives. Mm. Of course, he had about 30 illegitimate children, which complicated things somewhat as well, too. But it was quite clear that by 1127, he was going to have no further children. The only other candidate was his elder brother's son, William Cleto, who at the time was Count of Flanders. And therefore, to help counter the claims of William Cleto, he nominated his daughter the Empress.
So was that unusual then for a king to nominate their daughter as their heir?
Never happened before in England.
So why do you think he went for his daughter over, say, his nephew?
Because he hated his nephew.
Oh, right.
Well, as one assumes so. Well, he was quite a nice chap, actually, by all accounts, and very, very heroic and all the rest of it. But there was bad blood between the two branches of the kingdom. But, of course, then his nephew solved the problem by getting himself killed in a siege in Flanders in 1128, which left the way clear for Matilda, or so you would think.
Yes, yes.
But, of course, Henry I knew very well the way these things worked, and he'd tried everything to guarantee his daughter's succession, marrying her to the most advantageous foreign match that he could make, which was his neighbour and rival, the Count of Anjou, who was one of the most powerful princes in the centre of France. That would have helped assure her chances, although I think he miscalculated there, because there's one thing you can be sure of early 12th century France is that Normans hate the Angevins and Angevins hate the Normans. And in fact, he probably may have actually sabotaged her chances partly by that.
Yeah, she thought that would cross his mind.
And of course, he got his nobles to do that all important thing, swear that they would support her when he died and would put her on the throne.
And did that actually count for anything during that?
It certainly counted for something, because in the a civil conflict that followed, and in the debates that followed, the fact that all the great barons and earls of England had sworn to support Matilda was brought forward as the ideological justification for rebelling against the anointed king, who was Stephen, because that was trumped by the oath that they'd sworn before. Now, most of the earls and the barons and the Norman counts had not supported Matilda. Mm. But still, it was a way of needling them.
Indeed,
when eventually a lot of them did turn against Stephen, it was, they said, because they were honouring the oath that they'd sworn before God.
So Henry dies. Does Matilda come back straight away to claim the throne?
That was bad timing. Henry died in the middle of a ferocious row with his son-in-law, Geoffrey of Anjou. And his daughter had taken her husband's part. So they were out of Normandy when he suddenly died in the forest of Lyon in Normandy. And as a result, opportunity knocked for those people who were ambitious enough to take advantage of the uncertain times. And it is said, well, at least it was said by the people who actually didn't honour their oath, that on his deathbed, in his last few days, Henry I, it took him a week to die, Henry I had released his barons and his magnates from their oaths so that they could actually follow their inclinations and the best interests of Normandy. And it's possible that that is exactly what happened, because what we know what happened immediately after his death is that the Norman barons, who were also many of them English barons too, went into conference mode. They had conference after conference. Who's the best person to succeed Henry I? We're not going to have his daughter. Let's rule her out. We're not going to have that horrible foreign husband of her. Mm-hmm. What will we do? Well, we will look around and see who's the best candidate. Now, the king had nephews. And the most potent nephews were the sons of his sister, Adela, the Count of Blois, another powerful central French principality. Not as powerful as Anjou, but powerful enough. Mm. And he'd had one of them at his court for years. And that was the younger son, Stephen, who he'd made Count of Mortain in Normandy, Lord of Eye in Lancaster in England, and who he had arranged a marriage to the Countess, the heiress of Boulogne, whose name was Matilda. And the Norman barons thought about it, and they decided, and it took them about 2 or 3 weeks to do this, that they would go for Theobald, the eldest son, who was the Count of Blois, because that would bring Normandy and Blois, which were neighbouring principalities, into alignment, face down Anjou, and also worry the King of France further up the Seine towards in Paris. And they elected Theobald as their new duke. Theobald arrived in Rouen only to discover that his brother had got on a horse, rode to Boulogne, got on a boat, reached England, found his way to London, where the Londoners had claimed him King of England, and where, with the help of his brother, who was the Bishop of Winchester, and the Bishop of Salisbury, who was the head of the government, got himself crowned.
So really seems to be the person who got there first really stood the most chance of being crowned.
As I said, opportunity.
Yeah.
Stephen started very well. He started so well that he didn't have to give anything away. I mean, his uncle, the dead king, Henry I, had to bribe his way into the good books of his aristocracy. He gave away vast amounts of money and land, to get the English aristocracy on his side so he could turn to Normandy and try and sort out things there. Stephen didn't have to do this. I mean, in fact, there are complaints, from well-known complaints, that, he was as new king, giving away nothing to them, Nothing at all. I mean, not nothing at all, but he didn't feel as though he had to be particularly generous to them. So his first grand court as king at Oxford in Easter 1136 got through a lot of business, and he made quite a few promises about the future running of the kingdom, but he didn't feel as though he had to give away land or money in any great quantities to have himself assured as king, because he felt perfectly confident.
He was quite secure then, even though, Matilda sort of lurking in the wings still, making plans, or to kind of, come and assert her claim?
Matilda could
or?
Do nothing. You see, the key to England, strangely, was Normandy.
Right, and because she didn't have that support there.
Without Normandy, you could not go on to England. And Normandy was secure for Stephen at this point, because his brother Theobald, although somewhat miffed, having been sort of miffed, having been to the throne, nonetheless actually rallied round his family and interceded with the King of France and got him to recognise Stephen, and indeed he and the King of France wrote letters to the Pope saying Stephen was the rightful King of England. So the Pope in Rome sends a letter, which to the barons of England, telling them that Stephen indeed is rightfully their king, and they needn't worry about the oath that they swore.
So what did Stephen do wrong then? Because it sounds like it was fairly kind of all set up for him.
He couldn't have had actually a better start, but he forgot what he should have known, that the key to England is Normandy. Well, there are other things as well that he failed to do. But things started well for him. I mean, a lot of it has to do with the fact that he trusted his younger brother, Henry the Bishop of Winchester, who was a superb diplomat and engineered all this sort of approval from the realm in general, got the support of the church, the Pope behind him. And, for the first year of his reign, 1136, 1137, everything went well. But in 1137, he made a massive mistake. He went to Normandy. That wasn't the mistake. That was the clever thing to do. And he had been told, go to Normandy, get accepted as Duke, make a great progress through the duchy, have a campaign against the Angevins, teach him who's boss, and after that things will be fine. But somehow things were not fine. Things went wrong in Normandy on that great progress. And the thing that went wrong was that Stephen began trusting certain factions of his aristocracy, the ones that he found most obliging to him, rather than his brother. The key to being a good king is to actually keep a balance of factions at your court. Henry I was extremely good at a master. You know, his nephew simply did not get it. He just wanted to be... Well, it seems to be he just wanted to be nice to his friends.
Yeah.
He felt safer when he had friends.
Yeah. So how did the rebellion pan out? What happened?
It was an unusual rebellion in the sense that it took a long time to generate it. It took a long time to generate. I mean, don't forget, Stephen had been king 2 years before he had any serious problems in England. Yeah. You know. So, I mean, in the end, you can only blame him for it. You know, he had so many chances.
Yeah.
And the nation took a long time to stagger into rebellion. But eventually it did. And when it did, it became seriously territorial. In essence, the southwest of England became detached from the rest of England. And there, you know, Matilda's cause was embraced. And the rest of England, the southeast, London, East Anglia, and to a large extent Yorkshire as well, that was loyal to the king. There was a war zone in between them, mostly along the Cotswolds, where terrible things happened. That was more or less the situation for the entire rest of King Stephen's reign. And the war went on. And it continued on, really, until Robert of Gloucester died, which he did in 1147. And when he died, the heart was taken out of the rebellion. And Matilda based herself for a while in Devizes, which became her capital, but could not maintain the struggle, and eventually she gave up. She resigned her rights to her young son, or her eldest son, Henry, and left Normandy, where she retired to the palace priory of Notre-Dame on the outskirts of Rouen, where she stayed for the rest of her life.
Obviously, we've come to Wallingford today. Where does Wallingford fit into the story then?
Wallingford is an unusual castle, at least as far as Stephen's reign is concerned. It's a very powerful castle. In Stephen's reign, or at least the beginning of Stephen's reign, it was the possession of one of those coterie of administrative barons who had kept Henry I's government running so efficiently. His name was Brian Fitzcount. He was the actual son of the one of the counts of Brittany, hence Brian Fitzcount, Brian son of the count. Mm-hmm. He'd done quite well out of his service to Henry I. He was given the heiress of Wallingford as his wife, Matilda. He was given Matilda as a wife. She was the heiress of Wallingford. And he was also given the honour of Abergavenny and the Welsh March as well. You know, so essentially he had two lordships. And he was one of those administrative barons who, along with the other administrative barons, including Robert of Gloucester, started by accepting Stephen and hoping that, you know, the good times would continue and that Stephen would be the same sort of king to them as Henry I had been. But he was very soon disabused, and he was one of those barons whose Welsh lordships were attacked as a result of the fact that Stephen didn't do anything about Wales.
Okay.
So he had that much reason to resent Stephen. But even when the first outbreak of rebellion happened in 1138, he didn't join in.
Okay.
He stayed loyal for a while. He did not actually rebel until the Empress herself arrived in England. And at that point, one of his colleagues, Miles, Sheriff of Gloucester and Hereford, rode over to Wallingford and had a conference with Brian. And at that point, Brian declared for the Empress, which in this case, certainly in the case of Wallingford, was a risky thing to do, because Wallingford was on the outer fringe of Robert of Gloucester's area of power, and it was always therefore going to be on the frontier between Stephen's power and Matilda's power.
Yeah.
And there were two crucial incidents, two crucial periods in the reign when the defence of Wallingford essentially kept Stephen at bay. It disrupted Stephen's control over the central Midlands. You know, it commanded a key bridging point of the River Thames. It blocked the way from Oxfordshire south.
Yeah.
You know, and it also gave the rebels a sort of salient on the east side of the Cotswolds into King Stephen's territory. So it was under essentially constant attack throughout the reign. Brian Fitzcount's also a very interesting person in that, you know, he is one of the few barons who actually sat down and wrote out why he was supporting Matilda.
Yeah.
Yeah, he got into a row with the Bishop of Winchester, Henry, the brother of King Stephen. actually wrote a letter, which survives, to Henry Bishop Winchester, saying why he was doing the things that he had to do to survive, you know, plundering merchants and all the rest, and decrying Henry Bishop Winchester for not standing by the oath that he had sworn in 1128. They always went back to that oath.
Yeah.
You know, the oath that was sworn in 1127, 1128... they always went back to that.
Even though he had initially gone for
Stephen too. Yeah. But he, in the end, was true to his oath, whereas Henry was not. And as a result, he was better than Henry. Yeah. It all came down to good faith. And that, of course, reflects on what was one of the truisms of medieval aristocratic life, that a lot of your reputation depended on the fact that you were a loyal man who kept faith.
Right.
You know. And it was always a way of undermining your standing in society if you could be accused of not being a loyal man, of being disloyal.
Yeah. You know. And did Matilda actually ever come here?
Oh, yeah. On at least one known occasion, when she escaped the siege of Oxford in 1142, which she did by shitting over a wall.
doesn't sound very queenly.
No. Not entirely sure of the details of this. She may come out by a Austin Gate, it's difficult to know. But anyway, when she got out of Oxford Castle, it was snowy and she was muffled in a white coat, and under the escort of three or five knights, the sources differ, she was huddled off to Abingdon Abbey, and from Abingdon Abbey she came here.
Yeah, which is not that far really, is it?
It's not that far, no.
No.
Yeah. She was sheltered here before she returned to Devizes, which was her principal castle and her capital when she was contending for the throne.
Okay. So, the stalemate, though. So after Matilda went back, sort of tail between her legs, given up on her claim, what happened to the monarchy in England then, after that? So Stephen's back on the throne?
Stephen is back on the throne. Well, he's back on the throne after 1141.
Yeah.
And never leaves it again.
So they were quite happy to have him back, even though he'd been...
Stalemate continued until Robert of Gloucester died, and then something very strange happened. Civil wars, of course, eventually cause, you know, massive emotional and physical exhaustion in the populace. And eventually people realise that there aren't any going to be any winners.
No.
You know, and that the only way forward is by a settlement. But Stephen wouldn't settle. I mean, there were negotiations. I mean, in 1140, for instance, Stephen allowed the delegation headed by his wife, Queen Matilda, to meet with a delegation of the Empress, and have a face-to-face a sort of conference as to how the war could be settled, you know. So this is 1140. This is quite early on in the war. You know, and there were other conferences, another one in 1146. But it always, you know, sort of collapsed because of the intransigence of either party. People were always looking for a way forward, but nothing happened. As long as Robert of Gloucester was in charge, nothing ever would happen, because military victory was something that he was always after. He would never accept any terms. Once he was gone, there still was no settlement in prospect. But the barons, who knew each other very well, I mean, don't forget they'd served at the court of Henry I. This is a very small community of barons who are behind all this, no more than 500 people. And they know each other very well.
Yeah.
You know, what's that? That's a sort of large primary school full of people. You know, they knew everybody. You know, they knew each other. You know, and they were at war, and it was becoming more and more unprofitable that they should be at war, and their lands were being devastated, trade was down, and, you know, everybody was losing. So what you get after Robert of Gloucester dies is suddenly Angevin earls supporting Matilda begin talking to royalist earls.
Okay.
And they start organising from 1147, 48, 49 private peace treaties to limit the effect of warfare. The principals of the party couldn't make peace, but at least the magnates themselves could limit war. And that is remarkable.
Well, they sort of took it out of the hands of them, didn't they, really?
They took it out of the hands, you know. But it's remarkable not just for that, it's remarkable for the fact that these barons actually had a sense of the community of the realm, which should be a peaceful community. Mm. And if the king, who is the guarantor of peace, couldn't guarantee it, well, they would take control.
Yeah.
And they were guarantors. And that actually is how, in the end, the war ended. Finally, in 1153, Matilda's bright teenage son arrives in England, invited over by the barons, because Wallingford at that point was under close siege and it looked as though it was going to fall, which might just possibly hand the advantage over to Stephen. And Henry responded to the call of the earls of his party the Earls of Cornwall, the Earls of Hereford, and the Earls of Gloucester, and arrived with a very small army in Dorset, marched north to Devizes, and then from Devizes marched onwards to Malmesbury, which attacked and seized the castle. Makes a great tour of the kingdom in a military chevauchée campaign. Doesn't pick up much support, but eventually he circles down and he gets to Wallingford. And finally, Stephen manages to gather together a great army. His earls turn out for his summons. They gather on the other side of the River Thames at Crowmarsh Gifford. Henry II arrives, attempts to actually attack the king's army, but the king's a bit too fly for him and drives him back. And at that point, you have two armies facing. Henry II, as he will be, Henry, Duke of Normandy, as he was then, camped on this side of the river. The king camped on the other side. It's the great face-off.
Yeah.
It's that final battle that Stephen himself really wanted.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And what happens? The barons on either side tell the duke and the king, we are simply not going to fight. Let's sort this out. You know?
So once again, they've taken the power
they
out of the hands.
They take control. Yeah. And Stephen and Henry both say they're shocked at this. Well, I'm not entirely sure they might be, you know.
No.
Because it is so a problem. The barons themselves appoint a commission to a commission of bishops and a commission of earls to iron out a peace settlement.
Yeah.
Which is presented to both Duke and King at Winchester in November 1153. They accept it. Then together they head to London and seal a treaty which enshrines these terms, you know.
Yeah.
And the war is over. I mean, it's as simple as that. Yeah. And the war is ended not by a military victory, but simply by an act of the entire political community saying, no more, this is it. Peace is important. There's a way forward. And the way forward was that Stephen accepts and adopts Henry as his heir. You know, slightly easier for him because his own son Eustace at this point has recently died, his own elder son. And although it's very tragic for him, nonetheless, it's more of a blessing for the community because there's no longer going to be that sort of next generation of the struggle between Eustace and Henry. So Stephen accepts Henry. And as I said, he's a pleasant man, a decent man. And he makes the settlement work. Henry decamps from England back to Normandy because he's got more problems in France, and the peace settlement continues.
That was Charlotte Hodgman and Professor David Crouch. You can read an article about their visit in the January issue of BBC History magazine, which, as I mentioned before, is on sale now. And that's pretty much it for this week. Do join us next time when we'll be talking about a famed medieval knight and chatting to the latest biographer of Henry VIII. Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast, which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com, and we might read out your messages in future episodes. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, where you will find history quizzes, galleries, articles, and more. Plus, it's where you can download every single previous episode of this podcast.